I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. 40-some years ago, there was a refugee crisis brought on by the Vietnam War, followed by the genocide in Cambodia. People fled, often with few possessions, in fear for their lives, looking for a safe place to live and, for many, to raise a family. They lived in refugee camps and resettlement camps before coming to the U.S., including Philadelphia, where there were organizations ready to help and affordable places to live because of the city's many row houses. There are some interesting parallels to today's refugee crisis with refugees fleeing war and conflict in the Middle East. We're going to hear some stories about those who settled in the city back in the 70s, 80s, how they were received by their new communities, what we can all learn about coming to America as a refugee, and what they think about President Trump's refugee policy. And we have three guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Jake Blumgard is a reporter for WHYY's Plan Philly. He and WHYY's Katie Culinary interviewed refugees from Southeast Asia in Philadelphia. We're going to play some clips. Also, you can go to planphilly.com to read Jake's story and to hear Katie's piece. And Jake, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi there. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Toy Nguyen is with us as well, CEO of CMAC. He came to Philadelphia when he was 9 years old. This was back in 1975, a refugee from Vietnam. And Toy Nguyen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. And Sumala Chai is executive director of the Cambodian Association for Greater Philadelphia. Her parents fled the genocide in Cambodia. She was born in a refugee camp in Thailand. And Sumala Chai, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty. It's
You're
a
very
pleasure.
A pleasure to have all three of you with us. Jake, let's just get the conversation started. Why did you and Katie want to do this story?
I mean, in short, we saw there were a lot of contrasts between what was happening now in Iraq and in the Middle East in general and what happened in Vietnam and the states around it in the 70s and 80s. In particular, you know, there's just these consequences when, you know, America rolls into a place and engages in conflict with these states that are, you know, don't quite, you know, have the same level of, you know, armed forces and whatnot. And it often results in kind of, you know, the hierarchies and the political structures that are in place being, you know, overturned or at least really put in threat, and then that often, you know, results in, you know, just a lot of conflict and a lot of people being pushed out of their homes and their communities kind of falling apart almost, and that kind of, yeah, there's consequences, basically.
Toy, let me turn to you, and I wonder with today's refugee crisis, and I do want to get both of your stories of coming to America, but does today's refugee crisis get you thinking about your childhood, how you came to the United States, how you came to Philadelphia?
Absolutely. And it's been on my mind for the past 42 years. For the past 42 years, I think a lot about my experiences as a young boy who came to Philadelphia in 1975.
A nine-year-old boy.
Yes, a nine-year-old boy. And, you know, the parallels that I see today with many situations, specifically the Syrian refugee crisis, and I'm not just touched by it, but I see a lot of parallels in the situation that my family had to go through. You know, leaving, being uprooted from everything that we knew about to come here. And, you know, and I as a former refugee, hope that my family and the communities that we live in can extend the same type of warmth and welcoming to any new groups of refugees.
And I do want to pick up on that. Sumala, obviously every refugee has their own story. Your parents fled Cambodia, really fled the genocide in Cambodia. So you were born in a refugee camp and obviously have no memories of that. What is your first memory of either coming to America or being in America?
It was actually the time where we resettled. We were resettled by the Mennonite Central Committee.
In Lancaster, right?
In Lancaster. And in Intercourse, Lancaster, we rented half of a farmhouse with the Amish family. And so those were my first memories here.
How old were you at the time?
I was probably three or four.
And did your parents, did they talk about Cambodia? I mean, obviously the genocide, the horror of what happened in that country, was that something that they shared with their family or you overheard in conversations?
Oh, no. I only overheard bits and pieces. And I actually didn't know the extent of the loss that my family had until I was 14, where really? I realized I had an older sister that passed away. And so they don't really talk about it. They still don't. It's just slipping through conversations that they would give me these facts. Or even when I went to Cambodia myself, I pieced together what happened, but there's still many gaps in that history. And that's just because of just the trauma and the deep wounds and scars where even with me talking about it, you get emotional.
I can only imagine.
So I can only imagine how my parents could really relive that through storytelling of it.
Well, let me play a clip, and this is an interview that Jake and Katie Culinary did about Cambodia, the genocidal actions by the Khmer Rouge, forcing almost all residents out of cities. They made lists of people that they wanted to exterminate, and that included a teacher named Ka Or. They spoke to him about the night that he fled. He learned that a friend of his had been beaten to death. Another friend warned him that he needed to escape or he might be killed himself. You'll hear him breaking down as he remembers telling his wife, Kim Orr, that he was leaving. Let's give it a listen.
I work as a teacher. Teacher is a part of the government staff, you know, in Cambodia. So they kill all the literate people. You know. And that night, one of my friends, he told me, he said, one of my friends, it was arrested and they killed this. They beat him until he died. One of my friends said, look, if you don't go, they're going to take you tonight. And I told my friend, I said, look, honey, I cannot. I had to leave you. I cannot stay. And that night, I escaped.
I mean, Jake, it is such a reminder about how painful it is for so many to be refugees. Yes, they're looking for a better life. They're looking for a safer place. But what they have to leave behind is just so devastating.
Right. And I would really like to draw the parallel there between what happened with Cambodia is that the U.S. dropped a lot of bombs on Cambodia between the kind of like late 60s and the 70s. There was kind of a secret war waged against the country, which was not officially engaged in the Vietnam War at all, but kind of got sucked in because the North Vietnamese were using it to bring troops to the South. And in response, the U.S. just bombed the heck out of it. For years and years and years, and that really created the conditions on the ground that allowed the Khmer Rouge to take power. Prior to that, they've been a pretty minor group that didn't have a lot of support, but basically because of the chaos and all the bloodshed, which is what happens when wars are waged, it kind of creates this vacuum that they were able to fill.
Looks like you want to add something, Simala.
Yeah, so yeah, the bombing, it was a two-year bombing campaign. Cambodia was neutral. We might have had some closer relationships to China, which at that time with the Cold War was a threatening factor. And the thing that is just mind-blowing at this time is the Khmer Rouge, they were only able to build up their propaganda of fundamentalistic anti-Western propaganda because of this bombing. And that's what just launched the whole unraveling of our country, the displacement that's happened and how, you know, we became refugees here.
And there are some just eerie parallels, I would say, to what we're dealing with today. Toy, let me go back to you. Your father worked for the United States in Vietnam, came to this country. You went first to Guam, then to Hawaii, then to Indiantown Gap, and then finally to Philadelphia. How did your parents talk about Vietnam?
I think, like Somalis' parents, they did not talk about it very much. And I think I remember bits and pieces of their frustration of having been resettled and having lost everything and coming to Philadelphia. And my father specifically, who was a well-educated man, you know, speaking fluent English and French.
In fact, a rather prosperous man.
Yes, and well-educated, came here to America and hoping that the U.S. government, whom he had served very loyally, would take care of him and by extension, my family. But they did not, you know. I think that the government felt that they had done enough by airlifting us out and bringing us to the United States. And his first job in the United States was a security guard at the John Wanamaker Building in 1975. Mm. And that, in many sense, was very disillusioning for him. And it took years before he was able to work with the government to recover his GS status, and eventually started working for the U.S. government again.
You were a boy, a nine-year-old boy. What was this experience for you? Obviously, for parents, it's a wholly different mm-hmm. experience, but for children, it can be very different.
Well, I look back, and I remember, I think, some very traumatic moments, especially on the day of the our departure from Vietnam. We were awakened by a bomb that had exploded behind where we were living. And about 4 in the morning, my dad came with a Jeep and basically said, "You have 20 minutes, pack up the Jeep, and we're leaving." And it was a very difficult moment because at that time, my grandmom, my father's mom, decided that she was too old to travel, and therefore she would stay. For my dad, he probably regretted that decision for a long time.
Leaving his mom behind.
Right. excuse me.
It's a very emotional topic to talk about all of this.
And I think that it was many years, it was probably about 3 decades until he was able to go back to Vietnam, and by that time, right, his mom had passed. So I think there were, for me growing up, for me, the journey was kind of fun. I was too young to really understand, so to me it was like an adventure with my older brother. But it wasn't until much later that I realized how difficult it was for my parents.
Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Toy Nguyen, also with us, Somala Chai and Jake Blumgart. We are talking about the refugee crisis of a generation or two ago, people coming to the United States, including here in Philadelphia, from Southeast Asia. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. And we're getting stories. We're hearing stories of people who came to Philadelphia, part of the refugee crisis from the Vietnam War, the genocide in Cambodia. And we'd love to hear from you. Our comment line, you can also both call and text our comment line, 267-405-2006. We want to hear your stories of either being a refugee or being part of a family that were refugees. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me reintroduce our guest, Somala Chai, Executive Director of the Cambodian Association for Greater Philadelphia, was a refugee, actually born in a refugee camp in Thailand. Toy Nguyen is CEO of CMAC and came to Philadelphia when he was 9 years old, 1975, a refugee from Vietnam. And Jake Blumgart, reporter for WHYY's Plan Philly. He and WHYY's Katie Culinary interviewed refugees from Southeast Asia here in Philadelphia. We've been playing some clips. We'll play some more. You can also go to planphilly.com to read Jake's story and to hear Katie's piece. Let me go back to you, Toy, and it was a very emotional moment before that break talking about leaving your grandmother behind in Vietnam. But you had 20 minutes to take something as a 9-year-old boy to bring with you, I guess, to America or certainly out of your country, your home. What did you take?
Well, as a 9-year-old and my older brother at that time was 11 years old, we thought it was very important for us to take our comic book collection.
Of course.
So that's what we took with us. You know, we lived in fear for months where we had to, every time we went out, we had to wear backpacks, each one of us. And it has food, clothing, all the information, my family, some money or gold that was hard currency in case we as a family got separated. But my brother and I managed to stuff as many comic books as we could there. And when we got to Guam, we were told that there was a weight limit when we flew from Guam to Hawaii and that we had to give up our comic books. So my older brother and I, we actually went into the very remote part of Guam and we dug a hole and we wrapped the comic books as best as we could. And we buried it, and we made these signs with rock, and we promised each other that we would go back one day and dig up this comic book.
And did you? Have you?
No.
Just to complete the story, one of the things you were talking about, Samala, hearing Toy's story, but also thinking, I guess, about your own family and the tape that we just heard, was just the kind of trauma. I mean, we need to name what it is that we're talking about, especially people I'm thinking of coming from Cambodia.
Well, I would call it intergenerational trauma, because even myself, where I'm telling the story of my parents, I feel hurt, I feel wounds, and it's not something that just festers in you, but it's also something that weakens family bonds and the generational bonds, where not having not wanting to talk about these things, there's lack of understanding on both sides. And you compound that with, you know, the rage of adolescence, as well as the lack of a shared, firm language, is something where our refugee families are still trying to struggle through. So where, just like with my organization, the Cambodian Association of Greater Philadelphia, we do a lot of programming to address that. And it's about honoring the stories of our elders, but also sharing it and making sure that it's rooted and implanted in our younger generations as well. And just to talk about it, you know, the healing process comes from just talking about it. And there's where you can gain your power. You feel the injustice that then moves you to do something about and to make change.
So as difficult as it is to talk about, it's also important.
It is.
Jake, let me go back to you. And what was it about Philadelphia that drew these refugees to this city at this time?
So my understanding is that in general, so for one thing, particularly in the first wave, which was kind of when South Vietnam was falling apart.
this would be the 70s.
The mid-70s, 1975, to be very particular. But there were four camps that people were based out of, and one of them was outside Harrisburg. So for one thing, we were in close proximity. For another thing, you think about a lot of the row house neighborhoods in the 70s, they are very cheap because, there's a lot of white flight. There's not a lot of people who are wanting to move into South Philly or into North Philly or West Philly at that particular time. And so there's a lot of cheap housing. Also, it was close to mass transportation. You think about a lot of people coming from Southeast Asia. They didn't necessarily have experience driving a lot. So being close to public transportation is really essential to, people being able to access jobs. So there are just a lot of advantages that Philly had that other places didn't.
And it seems South Philadelphia was a particular draw. In fact, Toy, you live in the house in South Philly where your parents settled? Do I have that right?
Yes. So in 1975, we were resettled by HIAS, Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society. I just want to give them a shout out for that. But the first house that we were shown As my younger brother stepped out of the door after seeing the house, a bird pooped on his head.
Oh, jeez.
So my parents thought that was a sign of good luck.
Oh, good luck.
So we decided
to stay. Welcome to Philadelphia.
So we have been there since 1975. We have not moved out. We rented at first and then bought. But at the time of our arrival, 7th Street Corridor was a thriving business corridor, primarily Jewish community. It was called the 7th Street Market, one of three major markets in South Philadelphia, 4th, 7th, and 9th. And it was the late 70s where the recession hit the country really hard. And I would say that almost overnight, most of those businesses who had been so welcoming to my family shuttered their doors. Either shuttered their doors completely or moved to other parts of Philadelphia or Pennsylvania. And so for me, in many of the things I've analysis that I've done of why so many refugees were resettled on 7th Street, that was mainly the reason. It was basically cheap, affordable housing that was completely emptied.
With commercial possibilities,
with commercial possibilities. And I'll let Somala speak about how the Cambodian community has really made the neighborhood thrive again. It was a different moment in time. And
I mean, different, but also some interesting similar parallels. Somali, do you want to add to that? And then I do want to play another clip. In terms of, so the Vietnamese tend to live in this corridor, South Street Corridor in South Philadelphia, or 7th Street Corridor in South Philly.
Yeah.
How about for the Cambodians? Was there a certain neighborhood?
It is that same neighborhood, actually. Yeah, now it's really not just a commercial corridor, but it's a cultural hub for Cambodians traveling as far as New York and Virginia. This is the place where our big temple is there, where we have language-friendly professional services, travel agencies, tax accountants, as well as it's really one of a kind, the only other one that has such a great concentration of Cambodian businesses is in Lowell, Massachusetts.
It's in Lowell, Massachusetts.
Yeah, so even for me, like I want to talk about my experience, because I'm a transplant, you know. I wasn't Philly born and raised. I came from Lancaster, but Philly is where I really felt my power. I found my community, and I felt the value of my refugee story. And so my parents, to this day, I live here now, but they make monthly visits here to buy in bulk all of the specialties that make our home so rich and so cultural, and for us to maintain that tradition. So South Philly, 7th Street between Oregon and Snyder is really a special place for the Cambodian community, not just in Philadelphia, but on the East Coast.
That's fascinating. Mm-hmm. Let me play a clip, and this goes back to the Orrs. We heard him talking about the terror of leaving Cambodia. In 1981, they settled in South Philadelphia by the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, Toy, that you mentioned. And Jake and Katie asked him what he thought when he first arrived in the city, and here is what he said.
And the first time that I came here, I saw a lot of black people in around, you know. So I say, hey, maybe they put me to the wrong place, right? Because I saw they're American. It's America. They're all maybe white.
It's so interesting, Jake, to come to Philadelphia, which is such a diverse city, and to expect to see just white people.
Right. Well, I mean, I think it just speaks to the fact that, you know, people didn't really know what they were walking into, and that there wasn't a lot of prep work done to, like, kind of teach people about where they were being moved to. You know, if you have a very particular idea of a country that you have never seen before, and you live on the entire other side of the world from, and perhaps especially, you know, back then, maybe all you've seen of America are,
soldiers.
You know, are soldiers or like American movies, you know, where especially back then, a lot of white people in American movies. I mean, it's just a totally alien neighborhood kind of that you're moving into, and you have no idea.
Tor, you wanted to add to that?
Yes. So I think what Jake is speaking to is refugees are primarily or traditionally settled in very economically depressed areas, just for the practical sense of it. And South Philadelphia, the South 7th Street corridor, as I had explained before, was one of those, you know, economically depressed neighborhoods. So even today, or especially today, it's now the most densely populated Asian Pacific Islander community in Philadelphia County.
Wow.
In 19148, 147. You know, but for me, as a child coming to the United States, I didn't, you know, I was not burdened by racial stereotypes. So my classmates were African Americans, Italian Americans, Irish Americans, Polish Americans. And these were my friends. These were my crew, if you call it. And we hung out with each other. We protected each other. And you know, something kind of interesting happened later on because I came in 75, but then the subsequent waves came, you know, in 79, 80, et cetera.
Early 80s, yep.
And by then, I guess I had been established as a member of the community, right? So even though there was only me and my older brother, if the neighbors yelled at us, they called us Mexicans, actually. They used to tell,
wow,
hey, you kids, you Mexican kids, get off our stoop.
Oh, wow.
And my brother and I used to look at each other and said, what are Mexicans? We're not Mexicans. We're Vietnamese. And they're like, what are Vietnamese? Just get off my stoop. But something strange happened, and I shared this with Samala earlier, that my friends started calling the new kids, the new refugee, Asian refugee kids that were settled in the neighborhood, they called them chinks and gooks in front of me. And that was very curious to me that, and I turned to my friends and said, guys, those are my people, right? So if
didn't see it that way?
They didn't see it that way. They said, Toy, you are not them. You are one of us. And it is a very difficult identity situation here.
Sure.
As a young boy trying to grapple with identity issues. I know that those people that they just called all these racial epithets are me, but I'm also
them. Exactly.
And I think that identity has stayed with me.
That sort of struggle about how you fit in. I wonder, is that for you? Is that true for you, Samala? And you think for girls who were refugees, was it a different kind of experience?
So I would say my experience was entirely different from many of my my brethren's that were resettled here in Philadelphia. I did get the generosity and the curiosity. So things were quite nice for me in Lancaster. But then I do want to talk a little bit about when the big wave, when the big influx came. Toy came in 1975. So by 80, 81, that's when we came in massive numbers. And that's when the sentiment kind of changed a bit from being generous and curious to being, I wouldn't want to say territorial, but just mm-hmm. like, well, what's going on? What's happening to
people?
My neighborhood type of thing. So the reception that our Cambodian community got wasn't so friendly. And, there was a lot of racial tension, horizontal racism, being in a place that's resource poor and, the way that you exert your self-determination to protect your family and to just protect yourself block by block by all the bullying is, there were some gangs that formed and whatnot. And to this day, because of that incident, our community is facing a deportation crisis as well.
Even today?
Yeah, and we're not a part of that immigration conversation, but we are deeply affected by it.
Let me go back to you, Jake, and just to sort of, for our listeners who may not remember, maybe weren't alive or were too little to remember, when you go to the 70s and 80s, there were problems of employment, as mm-hmm. you described, Toy, people leaving the city, looking for a different kind of community. There was communism. Certainly the Cold War was there. There were racial tensions, as you mentioned as well. Loss of manufacturing jobs. There was a lot of dislocation that was happening. And then you have refugees coming in. And interestingly, presidents largely welcoming refugees, a very right. different kind of situation from today.
Right.
Can you speak to
yeah,
that?
Yeah, it's really interesting. When you go back and read the newspaper articles from the 70s, the polls look a lot like the polls now. The vast majority of Americans do not want Vietnamese and Cambodian people to be resettled in America. There's a lot of political blowback. There's even, it's not even necessarily a ideological thing. There's a lot of even what you might think of as progressive politicians who, there's one quote I found from a George McGovern. George yeah. McGovern. Sorry about that.
I know that because I was around then. But yeah. Go ahead.
He and he said, you know, he was the yeah. He ran for president 3 years earlier, known as a quite left wing guy. And he said that he thought the Vietnamese would be much better off if they stayed in their country, which is not something you would expect from him. But anyway, there was a lot of pushback. There were a lot of fears. Yeah, there's some kind of vague fears of communism coming to the United States, although I don't really think that was a particularly serious concern. But also there was a recession in the mid-70s too, and right. I think that was really the big thing, was that people were really worried about jobs and wanting America to take care of its own first. But in contrast, what's going on now, the president's basically decided in 1975, the Republican president decided to allow Vietnamese folks in, and in 1980, Carter decided to let people in too. So very different.
We are talking about the refugee crisis of the past, of the near past in the 70s and 80s. Talking with Jake Blumgart, with Toy Nguyen, and with also Somala Chai. And you can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and stay with us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moskowain, and I'm talking with Somala Chai, Executive Director of the Cambodian Association for Greater Philadelphia, Toy Nguyen, CEO of CMAC. Both of them came to the U.S. and came to Philadelphia as refugees, and also with us is Jake Blumgart. And you can check out his story on planphilly.com about the refugees that came to Philadelphia in the 70s and 80s. He collaborated with WHYY's Katie Culinary, who has a piece embedded in that story, and you can check it out. You can also join us. You can call or text our comment line 267-405-2006. If you have similar stories of refugees, we want to hear them. And we've got some comments here, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Picking up on what Jake said, and I know, Toy, you want to talk about this. We are a nation of immigrants. We are a nation of refugees. We pride ourselves on that. And yet we know from today and what we're talking about today, and even the refugees that came over 100 years ago, we're not necessarily particularly welcoming to refugees or immigrants who come and then settle and then become Americans. How do you understand that, Toy? What is the message?
Well, you know, my family's been here 42 years, and I would say that for 42 years it has been a struggle to basically prove ourselves that we are, in fact, Americans. It's interesting that even as my family, I have family members who struggle to prove, you know, themselves or ourselves as Americans. Sometimes we say really, some members of my family say really disparaging remarks about newer groups of immigrants and refugees. And that has been a source of frustration for me. And as a nation of immigrant, and for myself as an avid historian, fan of American history, you know, I understand that this is a country of immigrants, right. Aside from those who were forcibly taken here, and the Native Americans.
Absolutely.
We are, the rest of us are immigrants, right? And it's it's frustrating and disturbing to me that even today, there are many people in the Vietnamese community who speak so disparagingly of the Syrian refugee crisis and the fact that they support, you know, extreme vetting. In essence, prior to President Trump's introduction of extreme vetting, our vetting mechanism and system is already extreme, right? And disproportionately, we don't see acts of terrorism in the United States that warrant those types of you know, greater vetting. So I would just ask my fellow Americans that, you know, just go back to your roots, understand your history, maybe go back one generation, three generations if you have to, but be proud of who you are and really welcome new people to this country.
Well, let me play another clip, and this is from an interview, from interviews that Jake and Katie did. This is a man named Chin Dinh, served in the South Vietnamese Navy, fled to the U.S. in 1975 when the country fell to the Viet Cong, retired mechanical engineer, and he says, interesting, the situation for today's refugees is different. He believes the U.S. government has to be even more careful about who it accepts because of terrorism, something that was not considered when he and his family arrived in war-torn Vietnam. Let's give it a listen.
In my own opinion, maybe just need to vet people more carefully. That's all. But then a lot of the refugees, they are good people. Not all of them are terrorists, everything. Maybe just a few of them. But we need to vet them to make sure that we accept the good people.
Samal, is there a kind of a generational difference, you think, when it comes to thinking about refugees, today's refugees, yesterday's refugees?
Okay. So let me be a little controversial here, but I kind of do feel that, you know, what Toy is saying and what Mr. Din was saying is just a product of the language nowadays and the fear-mongering that's all around. And for certain media outlets or whatnot, it's there, and you don't have a comparison, or you're just so bombarded by it that it's really hard to step back because you're pushed by your emotions, and for the fear and the tragedies that you've gone through before, you know, you're a little bit more vulnerable to that speak as well. So that's one thing that I want to point out. And can you repeat your question again?
I was just thinking about generational differences. Okay. I mean, there often are generational differences. It doesn't matter whether you're a refugee or not.
Yeah, so speaking from the Cambodian refugee story is our elders, those who have survived what they had to survive to get here, didn't speak or didn't express their independent thoughts. That's how they can draw breath today is because of that. So sometimes what they believe or what they keep in their home isn't necessarily what they're going to say out there. So maybe that's a generational shift, but my shift, I feel incumbent to really point out those things because I don't have that fear instilled in me.
And
yes, exactly.
Jake, you want to add to that?
Oh, I was just going to say, in the interview, he was also kind of talking about how, you know, with the Vietnamese army, the communists, they didn't really have a particular interest in, you know, terrorist attacks in the U.S. or even the Khmer Rouge also were not, you know, they were focused on their own projects, basically, as horrific as those were. Yeah, I mean, we were, I guess, a bit surprised that, but he also wasn't, like, trying to say, you know, he wasn't advocating keeping all refugees out or anything like that. But he did see this very stark contrast between his situation and he said he wasn't vetted at all, which of course is not quite true because in the way that he came over, and it was all these people who've been working with the Americans for years, and so the Americans knew who they were, they knew they were on their side, and you know,
a little bit easier
brought them out
to vet from there. Let me read a couple of comments here. A text from a listener: are the guests American citizens? How do they feel about President Trump's negative policies on accepting immigrants, including refugees? Now, I feel like we touched on that, but let me let me sort of half throw that at you, Toy, which you said you still feel and your family still feels you have to prove you are American. What does that mean? To prove, I mean, here you are, you've been living here for 40-some years.
Well, I think Asian Americans in general, regardless whether you're a Cambodian or Vietnamese American or Chinese Americans, we're known as many things, Mato minority, one of them, but perpetual foreigner is another one, where I think the race dialogue in the United States, or the discourse, is basically a dialogue. It's a, you know, it's acceptable if you're white or black. And I think for the most part, brown or yellow, Latinos and Asians are precluded from that, although, you know, Latinos are being more and more included in that that discourse. And perpetual foreigner basically is that even today, having lived here for 42 years, I will still get compliments on how intelligent I am and how well my English is. And I always say back that, yeah, your English is pretty good too. Just to remind people of how dumb those comments are. But essentially, because I grew up in such a diverse community where my best friends were, for many years, were Italian and Irish Americans, but because of this race discourse, their families became part of America within probably the first generation, but by the second generation, it was over. You were white, right? But they forget the history of how Irish Americans or Italian Americans, Polish Americans, Jewish Americans, you can name them all, how oppressed they were when they first stepped into this country. And I think people forget that, and I just want folks to to go back and really interview your grandfather, interview your great-great-grandfather or grandmom. You know, understand the pain of those things and try to translate that into the moment. And then you might get a fraction of how Somalia and I, as first-generation refugees, know.
How you feel and what you know. Yeah, go ahead, Somalia.
Yeah, just to extend a little bit more on what Toy was saying, I think, the pressures of being accepted to be American, I feel, is the pressure to conform, to not question the socioeconomic situation of where we're at, and to not want to change those things as well. So it's just going along with mainstream, going along with what's the culture that's there, and not wanting to put other layers, or making that culture a little bit more diverse, or inserting your own identity and your own roots into that, where that's where I feel kind of where to be accepted is to not bring out any more of yourself, but what's already in the history books. Yeah.
Let me play one more clip. This is Saran Chan, born in a refugee camp in Thailand. And like many, refugee children from Southeast Asia, he spent his summers helping his parents pick blueberries in South Jersey. Let's play this and we'll talk about it.
It's hot. Hot. Yeah.
No bathroom.
Yeah.
You got poop in the field. I think it's a cultural experience for the Cambodian Americans in the city. You know, I started when I was 8. In the summer, you'd work. They'll pick you up, and it's not like a walk in the strawberry fields. It's pesticides. They don't protect you. Whatever you wear is you're in the fields, you know what I mean? And you'll see them spraying things. You don't know what the heck it is. But if you're able to work and make cash right then and there, you know, you're able to provide for the family. So it was more of an opportunity than anything.
Picking fruit or blueberries in South Philly, you both did it, right? Small?
Well, I actually, I did spend most of my summers here in Philadelphia. My parents brought me here. And actually, I'll do a little flip to that. My parents didn't allow me to go pick blueberries because that was like that's where you found your summer love.
Oh.
So I was isolating. Yeah, so I actually was in the sweatshops in Philadelphia.
Really?
But I always wanted to go pick blueberries. But most people, my cousins or whatnot, they did come here. I have relatives from Pittsburgh that you found a family to adopt you over the summer, and you wake up at like 4 a.m. to go pick blueberries. Because it was hard work. It was like, you know, pennies on the pint that you would get. But it was a village. It was a community. It was a gathering that was really nice and nurturing for us. So I didn't pick toy picks.
Well, I want to get back to the sweatshops, okay. But Toy, you pick blueberries, right?
Yes, just for a little while. I mean, for my family, it was just for a short period of just to bring in supplementary income, you know. But I proved to be so bad at it that I was so slow that I didn't make any money, essentially.
I pick blueberries. It's really hard.
And my family basically said, you know, you better hit the books. You better do well in school because this is not for you, man. And you know, in hindsight, we laugh about it, but that's the type of reality that I think refugees, you know, with all the good stuff with Somala mentioned, where refugees were able to congregate and build a community, but it's no laughing matter, right? And when this country says that immigrants or refugees are a leech on our community, we're taking jobs that no mm-hmm. one else wants. No one else wants. But you love your blueberries, don't you? You love your blueberries and your beautiful shakes and your desserts. Think about who's picking them. And they're doing a job that you don't want. So, you know, let's be fair about that.
What kind of sweatshop, Samala?
In garages. They were like subcontracts from other big factories where they would have families that would open up their garage and have maybe five or six machines. And when I was little, I would just cut the excess string that comes out from sewing, package them up, and that was also like 10 cents a box or 10 cents a dozen that you would
and
make.
How old were you?
I started out when I was about 12.
Wow. Child labor.
Yeah, it was. But it was needed. And I think that's kind of why we stayed, too, because of those jobs. While Jake was talking about how transportation to factories or whatnot made it easy for refugee families to stay here, it was also those types of jobs, the blueberry picking and whatnot, where they just worked earnestly, you know, 20 hours a day to get in. That's where these jobs were.
Let me read one. We're almost out of time here. An email from Randall. If memory serves correctly, he writes, so there was something there was a significant number from Laos who were mm-hmm. resettled in Olney. A former church worked with some of them. Any comments from your guests? Jake, can you speak to that?
So I the thing I know about Laotians is the Hmong who are here, who are kind of a hill tribe who had been allied with the Americans in the Vietnam War, and they were in Philly for a little bit, but they really didn't like it here. I think they were based in West Philly largely, and they had a really rough time and ended up almost entirely moving out of the city, I believe mostly to Minneapolis.
And Toy, we only have about 12 seconds, but go ahead.
Yes, I mean, from Southeast Asia, there are at least there are the three countries: Laos, Vietnam, Cambodia. But I would say 50 or more ethnic groups. You know, we didn't even mention the ethnic Chinese, the Mian, the Mao, and now mm-hmm. from folks from Burma and Bhutan. So it's a beautiful, diverse place.
Well, I can't imagine Philadelphia without all of that. My thanks to all three of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Toy Nguyen, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. CEO of CMAC, came to Philadelphia from Vietnam at the age of 9 in 1975. Samala Chai, thank you for joining us as well.
Oh, Marty, it's been a pleasure.
A pleasure for us. She's the executive director of the Cambodian Association for Greater Philadelphia. Her parents fled the genocide in Cambodia, and she was born in a refugee camp in Thailand. Jake, thank you for coming in as well.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Jake Blumgart, reporter for WHYY's Plan Philly, and he, along with WHYY's Katie Culinary, have done stories on this. You can go to planphilly.com to read Jake's story and to hear Katie's piece. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you for joining us for today's Radio Times.